Endless Courting by Lalaith Quetzali, read by Cookie Mom 6067. Chapter 1. Three Questions. It's a well-known fact that things come and go, good things and bad things both. The same thing applies to knowledge. Even as new things are learned, or at the very least discovered or rediscovered, as the case may be, others are forgotten or relegated to being mere legends, myths, and sometimes not even that. There are certain things that were better known, better understood in ancient times than they are nowadays. In ancient times, everyone knew how to court an endless. Those creatures, beings, born to Mother Night and Father Time at the beginning of creation, with powers greater than any gods. They can only be courted in very specific ways. It starts with a statement of intent. There's no need for specific words, though some have crafted elaborate phrases, prayers, believing such a thing might help their chances. In the end, what truly matters is the suitor's intent. That declaration must be followed by commitment, and in due time, by gifts. They don't have to be material gifts, for in the end, what can you give to gods, and those more powerful than even them? What they truly care for are demonstrations of the suitor's commitment, of their loyalty and devotion. It is also quite expected that at some point the courtee will consider it appropriate to test that suitor's commitment by putting them through trials. How well the suitor does in them will say much about their intent as well. Suffice it to say, the courting of an endless has rarely come to a successful end. Destiny, for example. There was a time when many vied for his hand, his heart. Destiny never really showed favor to any of them. If asked, he'd say there was no point, as he knew from the start that those few that held onto their commitment, as far as receiving his test, none of them would pass it. He still gave them the test, though, for even in the failing, the world needed them, all those human prophets and oracles and clairvoyants. Even as they each failed in their attempt to court destiny, they served a purpose all their own, as destiny knew all along would happen. Destiny also knows that one day there will come one who, when he offers the test, when he offers access to a fraction of his power, will say no. And then the test will be passed, and destiny will finally have been successfully courted. Death's own courting is also a process, one that causes many to kill and or die. And as time passes and many things are forgotten, as history shifts into legend, most forget the truth behind death's test. A day will come, just like with destiny, when one will gather the pieces of her gift, of her test, unwittingly, falling in love with her a bit at a time. And on the appointed day, death will have her suitor. Many courtships go wrong, some so wrong. Destruction hates being courted, hates the way so many seem to focus more on that side of his being and not on what comes after. After all, while it is true that destruction is needed for new creations to come, without the latter, what's the point? So it's perhaps no surprise when he eventually doesn't just give up on courting entirely, but on his own function as well. Delight's own courtship turns insane in ways no one, not even destiny himself, could have ever predicted. Both her and her suitor driven to madness, delirium coming on the other side. Dear delirium, her mind too lost for her to care or even think about courtship at all. Desire has at first many vying for their hand, but when time passes, and none manage to pass even the simplest of tests, a moment comes when they become convinced that they aren't meant for a single suitor. After all, why limit themselves? Despair is one who never thought she'd have a suitor, and yet she does. A courageous, gallant man who refuses to give up, no matter the hardship. Their courtship comes the closest to being fulfilled until near the end, the suitor cannot help but succumb to despair and then to death. Despair is so deeply affected she loses herself, and a new despair has to take her place. The new one chooses to give up on courting entirely, not wanting to risk a repeat of what happened before. And then there's Dream. Of all the endless, he's perhaps the one who's had the most suitors, even more than Destiny. Deaths don't count because most of those that ended involved in her tests were never actually her suitors and only involved because said tests got out of hand in ways she never planned. And yet, no matter how far some of them might get, all of them fail sooner or later. The biggest failure of all is Nada. The human queen who pushes so hard in her devotion and commitment to her courtship of Dream, she forgets her own people, and then tragedy, on a cataclysmic scale, befalls them. There's a lot that happens in a very short amount of time. Dream truly does cherish her and wishes to keep her, but Nada blames herself for the tragedy that befell her people and perhaps even to a point her love for the endless. She chooses to die rather than finish the courtship. And Dream feels so deeply that he's been wronged, been betrayed, that he damns her to hell for her rejection. There are others after her, and hard as he might try not to care, sometimes Dream just cannot help himself. Calliope is a whole other mess. The Muse starts her courtship of the Endless, but she never finishes it. As things progress on a physical level, they both seem to forget all about the courtship, about the rules. And then everything goes so wrong. It's only after it's all over, as he's left grieving his beloved son alone, that Dream realizes where it all went so wrong. That he never thought of trials for his suitor. Doesn't mean the fates didn't go ahead and did it themselves, and the result was failure. Calliope might have been Dream's wife, but she was never his consort. They were never fully bound. And so when things got hard, their bond didn't just crack, it shattered entirely. And in some ways, so did the both of them. So time passes. Destiny has his consort. Death knows hers is coming, though it might be a while yet. Destruction claims not to care anymore. Delirium doesn't even remember. Desire insists they're not interested, while despair refuses to even consider it. And Dream, he won't hear a word about courting or suitors, not ever again. Which makes it quite interesting how Dream, of all the endless, finds himself courted over the course of several centuries without either him or his suitor being aware of it. It happens in stages. First, declarations of intent, even if they might not have gone in the way most would have expected. I'm not going to die. Why would any sensible creature crave an eternity of this? A first exchange. An initial agreement. Let us meet here again, Robert Gadling, in this tavern of the White Horse in 100 years. 100 years' time, on this day. I will see you in the year of our Lord 1489, then. A second exchange, an accord reached. Why are you here?
I'm here because I'm interested.
What do I have to do?
Nothing.
You live your life as you choose, then on this day, every 100 years, we will meet. So much is left unsaid. Yet sometimes the things unsaid count just as much as the ones pronounced. Perhaps even more. In the end, it's all about intent. One may make a bet, believing a man to be unable to handle living eternally, but that doesn't mean there isn't a part of him that's hoping for a different outcome. A man may suffer a downturn of his luck, experience terrible tragedies, but that doesn't mean he'll stop hoping for a better future.
So do you still wish to live?
Are you crazy? Death is a mug's game. I got so much to live for. Mistakes may be made. Faults, whether big or small, committed, but that doesn't mean one stops trying to get it right.
It's a poor thing for one man to enslave another.
In the end, hope always remains. One might also say it's hard to stop a courtship when they don't know it's taking place. Most would claim such a thing ought to be impossible. How can a courtship, especially the courtship of an endless, be happening without them knowing about it, without them agreeing to it? That's why intent is so important. One may claim to only be interested in a man's experience, in his stories, but that doesn't mean that's all one's interested in truth. A man may live life after life, may indeed even make promises of loyalty to a woman in one such life, but such promises will never surpass the vows his heart silently swore long before. Agreement can be expressed in more ways than with a mere yes, just like love can be expressed in myriad different ways, through acceptance, loyalty, friendship, understanding. As for the gifts, they can be varied from the simplest, most obvious, in the form of stories, of life after life lived, whether well or badly, experiences had, to the most extravagant in the form of a fight in defense of the other.
You need not have come to my defense. Clearly.
Still, I didn't want to be drinking alone here in 100 years' time. Some may even be refused. Like a banquet gone unshared, an ill-expressed offer of friendship, of companionship repudiated. Yet it's when the courtship comes closest to breaking that a decision must finally be made.
You dare suggest one such as I might need your companionship?
Yes. Yes, I do.
Then I shall take my leave of you and prove you wrong.
Hob rushes after his stranger out of the pub and straight into the dark, rainy night, before he's even fully aware of what he's doing.
Wait, he calls as loud as he dares. Please wait.
Things start getting strange. When the other man, who seemed to have no intention of slowing down, much less stopping, suddenly does exactly that, standing in the middle of the street, the rain drenching their hair, skin, and clothes in instants, Hob opens his mouth to say something, thank him for stopping, suggesting they go back inside, get out of the rain, maybe even apologize for the absolutely stupid choice of words. Like, he still believes he's right, but he didn't have to say it like that. He knows how proud the stranger is. He never gets the chance.
What have you done?
The stranger demands as he spins around, usually blue eyes going pitch black and seeming to pierce right through Hob's flesh and straight into his soul.
I don't, what?
Hob has no idea what he's even talking about. The last thing he, the very last thing either of them expects is when from one moment to the next, everything changes. The rain seems to have stopped falling. Their surroundings go unexpectedly blurry. It's like, almost like the world around them disappears, or maybe they're the ones who disappeared from the world. Hob opens his mouth to ask what the hell is going on exactly when he notices something else. They're not alone anymore. There's a woman to one side of them. Or are they three? It's so confusing.
What's going on?
Hob asks, blinking repeatedly, trying and failing to comprehend what's going on, a part of him wondering if he's dreaming or perhaps hallucinating.
Hob Gadling, the stranger pronounces formally. These are the fates, the three who are one, the one who is three, the Hecate.
The stranger bows his head at them as he introduces them, which prompts Hob to imitate him.
My ladies, he murmurs as respectfully as he can,
because what else can he possibly do?
Morpheus, it's been a while.
One of the ladies, Hob cannot pinpoint which one exactly, says. And Morpheus, is that his stranger's name? As thrilled as the immortal man is by the fact that he might finally have a name, he cannot help but feel disappointed that it wasn't granted to him by his stranger, that he didn't earn it. "You look agitated, love," another of the ladies points out. "Well, that's why we're here, isn't it?" another adds almost immediately after. Hob can barely keep up. He wonders if his stranger, if Morpheus, feels the same way, or maybe it's Hob's own humanity that makes him feel that way. "What?" Morpheus begins. "Oh no, dearie." The fates seem to take turns speaking through the sentence. "This time, we shall be the ones to ask the questions." Dream blinks, clearly not having expected that. Hob, for his part, keeps wondering what mess he's in now. "You've gotten quite far on intent alone." Once again, the ladies take turns speaking. "But ignorance can carry you no further. The time has come for decisions to be made." "Decisions?" Hob blurts out, confused. "About what?" "We ask the questions, dear," one of the fates reminded him sharply, if not unkindly. "Then ask the questions, ladies, and we'll endeavor to answer them," Morpheus offers. "On a day like this, 5 centuries ago, a courtship began," the maiden states formally. Hob almost sputters at the word courtship, while Dream's jaw would have probably dropped if he weren't too proud for something like that. "Offerings were made and accepted, gifts given and taken, tests put forth and passed," the mother continues, either not noticing or not caring for the men's surprise. "There were rights and there were wrongs on both sides," the crone points out. "Not all was good, nor all was bad, yet you both grew and learned of each other, for each other," the maiden takes over again. "And even when there was doubt, hesitation, failure, the courtship endured," the mother adds. "And now the time has come for the final decision to be made," the crone announces. It's all so shocking, and yet it's hard to tell if it's the fate's powers, the magic of courtship, or something else entirely. But as the ladies speak, it's like memories are playing around the two of them. Or maybe they're just inside their heads. Each of their meetings, only as they revisit them, they can finally see the details they each might have missed. Hob can see what originally prompted the stranger to approach him, how it all began with a bet, and when it changed into something more. How interested he truly was, and why. How Morpheus has long admired Hob, his thirst for life, his delight in things big and small, his capacity for change, his willingness to grow, to improve, his heart, his soul. Dream gets the chance to see how much he's always meant to Hob. How hard the man's tried to earn the endless's regard, how badly he's felt when he's failed, how jealous when another managed to draw Morpheus's attention, how dearly he's held the endless from the start, how Dream has long been his touching stone, the one thing holding him together, seeing him through both the worst and the best in the world. How much, and for how long, Hob has wanted to know more about Dream, as much as he possibly can. How lonely he feels at times, a loneliness only Morpheus seems to be able to abate. Their attention is pulled back to the present as the first question is asked. "Did you choose not to die?" the maiden asks, looking straight at Hob. It's a simple, if strange, question. And yet again, some kind of power allows him to hear all that is truly conveyed in that one question. Did you choose to live, to remain with him? "I did. I still do," Hob stutters a bit with his answer, though he's no less certain of it. "Are you interested?" The mother directs her own question to Morpheus. The same thing happens once again. Are you interested in this man, his stories, his life, lives, his heart, his soul? I am. Morpheus answers softly, yet with power at the core of each word. There's just one more question to go, the one that will decide it all.
Will you stay?
The crone inquires of the both of them. Will you stay with each other? For each other? Will you stay with each other in sickness as well as in health? Will you share the joy as well as the hardships? Will you stand by each other in the bad times as well as the good? Will you cherish each other? Will you love one another? Will you have and hold from this day and to the end of time?
We will.
The two kiss softly, gently, chastely, the epitome of a first kiss. From one moment to the next, the ladies are gone. Same as the blurry surroundings. The cobblestone street is back, dark night in London, the pouring rain. Hob and Dream standing exactly where they were when it all began, staring at each other. They're still holding hands. They don't even know when that began. Was it when they kissed? When they said their vows? When they went through all those memories and witnessed their love take shape, grow, flourish, without either of them having realized it at the time? Perhaps even before, when the two first came to a stop on a dark, rainy London street. Neither of them say a word out loud. It's like they cannot think of the right words to say, or perhaps it's more that they don't need to. By a silent accord, they start walking, heading to Hobbs' townhouse, a tiny part of Dream's power ensuring they will not be noticed. They never let go of each other's hands. Once in the house, clothes are shed, allowed to fall where they may. Hands explore bodies, followed by lips, tongues, teeth. The night is spent with two brand new consorts finding pleasure in each other again and again and again, until dawn finds them entwined in each other and the dove gray sheets on their wedding bed. Chapter 2. Aftermath. In the morning, some words are exchanged by the new consorts.
I understand that current human laws make it inadvisable for you to advertise your change in status, and yet I'd like to...
Dream murmurs, voice low and hesitant, making his nervousness painfully obvious. I'd rather... Human marriage or not, I'm your consort, and that's that, Hobbs states somewhat brashly. I hope I have not given you reason to believe me capable of being unfaithful, Dove.
Your loyalty is and has always been a trait to be admired,
Dream assures him. They both think of Eleanor. It's impossible for them not to.
I did love my wife. I'm not going to say I didn't. Doing so would not only be a most obvious lie, but it would be a huge insult, both to her and to you, Hobbs states as strongly as he can. But that love, it was always going to end. I knew that, even...
He swallows hard at the memory of how it ended.
Even had she not died as she did, I'd have still lost her eventually.
I knew that going in. It's...
Not sure what you might think of me for saying this, but even... When I was most in love with her, I never considered giving up my immortality for her. Not sure if that would have even been possible, but the fact remains, I never even considered it.
Hob, Dream begins, extending a hand to touch his immortal's face softly, tenderly.
I did love her, Hob continues softer, and I will always cherish her memory. The same as the memory of my Robin and little Cecily, but those loves were always meant to end. The love I feel for you, it will continue for as long as I live, which you must know by now will be forever.
Forever, Dream repeats, the smallest of smiles on his lips.
I was married once.
Love, you don't have to. Hobbs swallows. My bearing my heart to you does not mean that you have to do the same. He inhales sharply. If you want to tell me anything you want to tell me any time, I will be delighted to listen, but you don't have to.
I know, Dream assures him. I do know this. I was married once. It did not end well. In fact, none of my relationships ever went well. For the longest time, I was led to believe that I was at fault in some way, that I was too much in so many ways, too intense, too possessive, too clingy. I'm passionate both about my lovers and about my function. That means I can lose myself in both, and that means that at times it might seem like I'm forsaking one or the other, though nothing could be further from the truth.
He swallows.
I need you to understand, Hob. If I ever do something wrong, tell me, please.
Shh. Darling. Shush. Hob murmurs softly, embracing Dream tenderly, tightly. I am here, and I'm not leaving, no matter what. So you can be a workaholic. So what? It's not like you'd be the first one. If you ever stay away from too long, I'll just track you down, make sure you eat and rest periodically, and when you finish with whatever masterpiece you're working on, we'll just have to take a well-deserved break, a little vacation just for the two of us.
Dring blinks. He wasn't expecting that.
Honestly, love, you think you're the only one to ever get lost in something?
Hob chuckles slightly.
To ever be seen as too much in some things, not enough in others. I think it's just that you've never before found someone who fit you well enough. With all due respect to your former spouse, whoever they might have been.
Calliope. Her name is Calliope,
Dream points out. Like the muse, Hob blurts out.
Wait, you don't mean...
And that's how Hob Gadling finds out about his beloved's former marriage to an actual muse and the son they once had and lost. He also learns the basics about some of Dream's other paramours.
It's only now that I have you that I finally understand how things went so wrong every time,
Dream admits.
I'm not without blame. But I'm not the only one to blame, either. I never understood before why the endless courtship even existed, why it was supposed to be so important. Yet now I realize it could have never been anyone other than you. For who else could have ever accepted me, understood me, could have fit me so well as you, Robert Gadling?
Right back at you, my love. Hobbs' smile is the brightest it's ever been. Plans are made. Hob is still human, immortal, and now the consort to an endless he might be, but human he remains deep down. And his home is Earth. While he's not unwilling to one day in the future, if he ever tires of life on Earth or it becomes too hard to continue living as he has thus far, move to the dreaming more permanently. For the time being, he'll continue as he has thus far. Morpheus turns one of his dream stones into a wedding band for him, which Hob promises to never take off. The people around him will think whatever they want about it. That he's keeping his wife away from London. Married to a delicate woman who refuses to leave the house. A widower. It doesn't matter in the end. This, along with her own marriage bond, allows Hob to lucid dream every night without suffering the ill effects humans are subject to if they don't sleep properly. So Hob spends his days in the waking world and his nights in the dreaming. And as promised, whenever his consort's busy with his own duties in the throne room or the sands of creation, Hob keeps himself busy in the library, learning more about his consort, his function, and the man's own duties as royal consort. Lucien becomes a good friend and confidant, as well as a huge help, And whenever Hob determines Dream has been working too long, he goes and entices his beloved into taking a break, sometimes a few hours, others a few days. Things are so much better in the dreaming than they've ever been before. As for the two men, they've never been happier. Death's the only one who visits Dream with any frequency to notice it when things change. The rest of their siblings seem to be unaware of the developments.
Destiny might know, of course, Dream states thoughtfully.
If Pythia isn't keeping him distracted again. Death actually snorts.
My eldest brother's consort,
Morpheus clarifies at Hob's confused expression.
Before the two of us got together, he was the only one who'd found his consort.
By then, Hob has heard enough stories, not just about Dream's own experiences, but those of his siblings, to know how big a deal that is.
Mine's coming, Death states. A certain something. Nervousness? Eagerness? Hope? In her voice as she says it, I can almost feel them. I know that whoever it is, they'll be worthy of you. For there is no other way they could be your consort, Dream says, serious and tender all at once as he looks at his older sister. And I can only hope they'll make you as happy as my Hob makes me.
That, if it weren't because of how Death throws herself at her brother to embrace him tightly, Hob would have taken the excuse to give him a very long, very dirty kiss. Well, there will be time when Death is forced to depart to keep up with her appointments. In the years following their union, Dream works on making peace with himself and his past relationships with some help from Hob. Eleonora has long since passed, and the situation with Kalala was beyond him long before that, so he turns his attention to the ones he can still do something for. He handles Nada first. A visit to hell isn't either man's idea of a nice vacation, but it's necessary. Letting the Morning Star know that he's the first foreign ruler to learn of Dream's nuptials certainly puts the ruler of hell in enough of a good mood that Dream has no trouble finding Nada and releasing her from her prison. Given the option between spending time in the dreaming, moving on to the sunless lands, or being reincarnated on Earth, the once human queen chooses the last option. Death escorts her personally to where her new life is set to begin. Calliope is in some ways easier, while in others she's the hardest of them all.
She despises me, Dream explains to his consort. When we last came face to face, she told me she wanted to never lay eyes on me again.
I'm sure it won't be easy, but don't you think it's been long enough to have kept holding on so much pain, so much?
Hob trails off, trying to find the right words to express himself.
I think you've let your grief control you for too long, my love, the both of you. You need to talk things out. But more than that, you need to be able to grieve your son, to find, I don't know, some sort of closure.
He runs a hand through his hair.
Dealing with Robin's death wasn't easy, but was, in fact, the hardest thing I ever did. Harder even than when I lost Eleanor and baby Cecily. But it was something I needed to do, because until I accepted my grief and my pain, even my anger, he exhales, I was so, so very angry with the bastard who killed my boy in that tavern brawl, with the friends who took him to that place in the first place, with myself for not having been there to protect him. And yes, I was even angry with him for not looking after himself better. He snorts to himself.
Your feelings don't have to be logical, to be valid, Dream. You don't need to justify them, to justify yourself to anyone. All you need is to feel them, to accept them, and once you're ready, to move on. It really isn't easy. The first time Dream goes looking for Calliope in Greece, she refuses to so much as look at him,
But with Hob's gentle support, Dream keeps trying. It takes several visits, but eventually the muse deigns to talk to him, and ever so slowly the two talk things out. They don't only talk about Orpheus, about all that Dream felt and indeed still feels regarding his son. So many feelings he never truly knew how to express. They talk about how Calliope failed to see it. "I didn't realize it then, but I never really knew you, did I?" she murmurs quietly, waving a hand dismissively when Dream goes to say something to confirm it, be upset, apologize. It's impossible to tell, and that only confirms what she just said. "I do not regret us, Oneiros. I could never do that," she says eventually. "I may regret how it all ended, but I will never regret how it began. And I will never, ever regret Orpheus." "Neither will I," Dream assures her. Calliope insists on meeting Hob, wanting to take the measure of the man who's managed to successfully court not just one of the Endless, but her own ex-husband. It's strange, because while she doesn't seem to him any different than most men she's known, he's no poet or writer or any sort of artist. He's handsome enough, but not particularly enthralling, not to her at least. And yet there's just something about him. The muse is quite certain that even without knowing what she knows of him, had she met Hob in a random street, in a random city, on a random day, she would have instinctively known he's special. "You hold on to him, Oneiros," she tells her ex-husband eventually. "He's good for you." "Yes, he is," Dream agrees wholeheartedly. "And you," she turns to Hob then. "You stay with him, look after him. He won't make it easy, but while he might not admit it, he needs it. And oh, doesn't Hob know it?" "I will, m'lady, to the end of time," Hob states, bowing formally at her. And then she's gone. The next time they hear from her is more than 2 decades later, under very different and much more dire circumstances. A quest is undertaken then to free a muse from captivity, but that's a whole other story. In 1914, the Great War takes Hob, not entirely by surprise. He's old enough and has been through enough wars to be able to tell when one is coming. He enlists because he still feels a certain loyalty to his country of birth, though once he's in the front, he realizes this war is so much bigger and so, so much worse than anything he's ever been through before. It's, much as he might hate to admit it, in some ways too much for him. Which is why, a few months later, when Dream shows up in his tent in the middle of the night and practically begs him to leave the front to go with him, "I understand loyalty, dearest. Believe me, I do," Dream tells him, tears glittering like falling stars on the corners of his dark eyes. "But this war is destroying you. It's Hob. I don't want to lose you." It's the tears that do it in the end. Hob cradles his husband, legal or not in the waking world. Dream is his husband. Face between his hands, gently bringing him close enough for a kiss, where they can both taste the salt of their tears. "Okay," he murmurs hoarsely, "okay, get us out of here." Captain Rupert Gould is declared MIA and eventually KIA, while a few months later, Roland Gadlin arrives to a small town in South Ireland to work as the new teacher of the local school. In 1916, Dream and Hob are sitting on their back porch drinking tea and looking at the night sky when the Endless feels the magic drawing at him, pulling him away. Hob has no idea what's going on, but he refuses to let go of his beloved, and thus both are pulled through time and space into a stone basement in Wychcross, Sussex. While the summoning circle in the Magdalene Grimoire might have been altered enough to properly summon and bind an endless, it was never meant to hold both an endless and their consort. Which is why the moment Hob refuses to let go of his husband, and the magic is forced to take him along, the ritual fails catastrophically. With the spell already begun and having no knowledge of how to cancel it, it keeps drawing power from the Magus and his disciples. And when the energy proves not to be enough anymore, it draws on their life force. By the time Hob opens his eyes to his new stone surroundings, all those around the ritual circle, except for a single child no older than 6, are dead. The boy, for his part, chooses to flee, terrified of whatever his the Magus might have summoned, that it might claim his life like it has everyone else's. In the following days, the rumors go wild, and while there are some that do believe that the so-called Magus and his followers managed to summon something they shouldn't have, something that killed them before escaping, the most persistent rumor is of a mass suicide. All sorts of stories come from that, about the Magus and his cult, and what might have led all those men and women, including several minor nobles, a couple of heiresses, a famous actress, a decorated retired military man, and a well-respected museum curator, to killing themselves, especially when the lack of visible injuries, bar a cut to Baron Burgess's arm, makes discovering the cause of death complicated. Most believe the war to be in some way responsible, either grief over their personal losses, most of the members of the cult might have suffered, or perhaps fear of what might yet come. The Baron's young son, Alexander Burgess, is never able to tell a soul what happened that night exactly. He spends many years coming in and out of various sanatoriums, the trauma of the night's events having left its indelible mark on him. As for Hob and Dream themselves, the immortal breaks the ritual circle and carries his semi-conscious husband, the summoning having managed to affect him somewhat, out of that basement and to his closest safe house on the outskirts of Crawley, where they stay for several days until they're both sure the danger's truly past. After that, Hob uses his dreamstone to open a path for the both of them back to the dreaming, where he refuses to leave for several weeks until he's sure that his beloved is all right and that no one will be insane and or deluded enough to try and take him again. A few years later, Hob's working as a tutor. He's hired by the Kincaid family, where he meets the charming Miss Unity Kincaid. It's a tragedy in many ways. Dream realizes what his consort's young charge is becoming, what she's meant to be, almost right away. She's so young, so bright, so full of life, and such a threat to the entire universe. It breaks both men's hearts. Something Dream suspects deep down, and he swears to himself never to breathe a word of near his beloved, is that it might have been the dreamstone Hob carries that kick-started Unity's power as a dream vortex. She's so much younger than the ones who've existed before her. Unity might be young, but she's no fool. She can tell when the way Mr. Gardner treats her changes, when he starts looking at her with so much sadness. At first, she thinks it has something to do with the spouse the man has or had, clearly shown by the wedding band he never takes off, perhaps a child he's lost. And then Unity meets him and his spouse, his husband, in the dreaming, and the whole truth comes out. So what you're saying is that I must die or I'll end up killing everything and everyone, even though I don't want to, she summarizes, tears cascading down her face. She's shattered. She loves life so much. Is always so excited by every new thing she discovers and at the prospect of discovering more. Mr. Gardner has taught her so much, not just where it comes to the lessons she must learn, but about life, about living. She doesn't want to give it all up. She doesn't want to die. But how can she be so selfish? How can she put her own desires above the well-being of the entire world, of all the worlds? Her parents, her friends, everything and everyone, they don't deserve to die because Unity's afraid to do what must be done. Can I have a couple of days, she asked very, very quietly, to put my affairs in order, to say my goodbyes before. She cannot even finish the sentence, but she doesn't need to. Dream nods, both fascinated and grieved by the strength the young woman has, by her bravery, her acceptance of her fate. Hobbs says nothing either. He just tugs her tight until the two of them are ready to let go. Dream hates seeing the two of them hurt so much, especially his husband. Cannot help but wish there could be another way. Death, my sister, I stand in my gallery and hold your sigil. Will you speak to me? 2 days later, Hob kisses his husband with a hint of desperation before leaving for what he expects will be his last day as the Kincaid tutor. Dream watches him go silently from the bed before making his way into the dreaming, hoping some work will distract him, somewhat, from what's to come. At least that's the plan, until he receives two completely unexpected visits just a few minutes later. He's still reeling with shock hours later when his consort bursts into the throne room looking more than a little distressed. Morpheus opens his arms to him, holding his beloved tight, giving as much comfort as he can. It takes a little while for Hob to settle down enough to pay attention as the Dream Lord tells the story of the unexpected visits he received earlier. Unity Kincaid is dead. Died by her own choice. And while officially it was an accident, she fell into the river during her morning walk, and she drowned. Truth is, she planned it that way. She did as she said she would, set her affairs in order, discreetly said her goodbyes, and found a way to end her own life without putting the burden on anyone other than herself. Also, in such a way that her parents wouldn't have to deal with the knowledge that their only daughter killed herself, left wondering why they didn't see it coming, how they might have failed her. You say she's here? Hob asks when the story's all told. Settling down in her brand new cottage in a corner of Fiddler's Green, yes, Dream nods. We built it together. Her perfect home. I'd talked the matter over with my sister before, about offering Unity the possibility of an afterlife in the dreaming. It's something that's usually only offered to those who die while sleeping, and never before to a vortex. Yet it did not feel right to not make the offer to such a brave girl. I granted her leave to visit her parents in their sleep. Of course, like most humans, they'll think it all just a dream, but it might offer some comfort to her. Hobbs says nothing. He hugs his husband tightly. He realizes Dream kept his plans from him and can even understand why. Why get up his hopes where it might not even be possible, or when she might have refused the offer? He understands, and he's just so happy. He cannot even find the words. It's probably a good thing that there's no need for them. His beloved understands just fine. Unity, of course, is delighted to see her tutor again once he's ready, and while it might not be perfect, in a perfect world, a young woman like her would have never needed to make such a choice, her life or that of the entire universe. It's not bad. Unity takes such delight in exploring the dreaming, in getting to know all the dreams and nightmares that she can. She becomes friends with Lucien and makes it her goal to one day read everything in the library. She becomes the closest Dream and Hob have had to a child since the loss of their sons. And while that thought, that comparison may hurt sometimes, it also brings them a soft, quiet joy. And life goes on. In the late 1920s, after a brief but eventful adventure to free Calliope from the bastard of a supposed rider who captured her and intended to use her against her will, Hobbs working at the British Museum. Nothing big, mostly assisting several of the museum curators. He's eventually assigned to work with someone new. Her name is Evelyn O'Connell, and to say she's had an interesting life is putting it mildly. They find out each other's secrets completely by accident, but it's a good thing. The two become close friends. She and her husband, Rick, choose him as their child's godfather. It's nice to have close friends, something that's almost family, aside from his husband and Unity. And of course, when things get beyond insane and little Alex gets kidnapped by an honest-to-the-gods resurrected mummy, Hob packs a bag and follows the O'Connells to Egypt to get the kid back. When the Second World War comes, Hob doesn't need his husband to say a thing, doesn't even need to look at the obviously desolate expression on his face. The immortal packs his bag and flees Britain, making his way to one of the few countries that don't seem to be involved in the war efforts at all. Well, when he first abandoned the front during the last war, it rankled him. He also realized that he's either gotten too old or simply wise enough to not want to be involved in wars anymore. It was one thing when going to war meant coming face to face with your enemies, when you were forced to stand up to them, to look them in the eyes as you took their lives. It's not that Hob liked doing it. He never did. Not even when he was a highwayman. His choice of profession was always about the things that would put a roof over his head and food on the table, not about what he'd like. But war nowadays is so impersonal and so terrifying. The ease with which people kill each other, the push of a single button capable of ending thousands upon thousands, hundreds of thousands even, of lives. It's more than his peasant mind can truly comprehend sometimes. Still, that doesn't mean he's ready to give up on life, on the world. He just needs to find different new ways of doing things, of helping others, of making things better. Sometimes things go well. Sometimes they don't. A lot seems to be happening in the waking world. With World War II, then the Cold War, the Civil Rights Movement, so many other wars that, while perhaps smaller in scope than the last ones, are no less terrible. Dream and Unity managed to convince Hob to take a break at least once a year. Spend a few days, perhaps even a couple of weeks solely in the dreaming, where he might truly rest away from it all. That Dream always makes sure to take that time off as well to spend it with his consort and their adopted daughter is an even bigger reason for Hob to agree with the plan. And time keeps on moving. It's the day after the anniversary of their first centennial that the call comes for an endless family dinner. For the first time ever, Hob is invited to join, as is Unity. It's a big deal, huge even. None of Dream's previous paramours were ever invited to an endless family dinner. Even Calliope, who was actually Dream's wife for a few decades. While Morpheus assumes that Calliope, having just been his wife and not his consort, might explain why neither she nor Orpheus were ever invited to the family dinners while Hob has been, that does not explain Unity. The family dinner ends up being quite interesting, to say the least. Dream, Hob, and Unity are the first to arrive to Destiny's Garden, where Unity's curiosity gets the better of her and she takes off to see everything she can. She's always loved seeing, exploring new places. The two couples are left to chat together, where Hob discovers he's met Pythia before. "Thank you so much," Hob murmurs almost reverently as he takes one of Pythia's hands in both of his, bowing low over it. "My lady, thank you." Pythia is a woman with long, deep auburn tresses and a dress the same shade of blue as her eyes. She's a beautiful woman, no doubt, but most importantly, a woman, Hob remembers. "Dearest?" Dream asks, somewhat hesitant. Remember in 1689 when I told you how they tried to drown me as a witch? Hob asked quietly, never taking his eyes off Pythias.
I remember, Dream nods grimly.
She's the reason I wasn't, Hob confesses. So quietly the two Endless can scarcely hear him. She arrived at my home, but minutes ahead of the pitchfork-carrying mob, got me out of there before they could find me. There was no time. I could barely grab what was closest to me, and the following years might have been very, very hard at times. He exhales, shaking his head. But I have no doubt that they would have been infinitely worse and far more traumatic were it not for her. Dream turns to look at his brother in shocked disbelief. There's no way his wife could have done something like that without him being aware, which means that his brother, his by the book, what's been written cannot be changed, brother, either sent, allowed, or at the very least was aware of his consort's intervention in a human's life, in Dream's human's life.
Thank you, is all Morpheus manages to say in the end.
And really, what else does he have to say? Perhaps the one other highlight of that particular family dinner is when Desire arrives last, their eyes going straight to the newcomers.
Well, 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 what have we here? Desire practically drawls.
A human, brother. Whatever would make you bring one such as him to family dinner, even if he's your current boy toy?
Consort, Desire.
Hob is Dream's consort, Death corrects. Can you not tell?
Hob is indeed Dream's consort, and such as our wedded brother, just like my consort, is your wedded sister,
Destiny points out evenly.
What? Desire cries out theatrically. And we weren't invited to the wedding?
It's not like there was time,
Hob tries to explain.
Oh, naughty big brother, you eloped, Desire cackles.
Hob opens his mouth, but Dream shakes his head minutely. While he has no doubt that his sibling must have been aware of what transpired between him and Hob throughout the centuries, considering their function, their wedding is a very important, very private matter, and not one he's willing to hear Desire mock in any way. Unity's own snort manages to derail Desire's attention and intentions entirely.
And who might this be then?
Desire looks her up and down slowly, intently. For her part, Unity just snorts again before turning her nose purposefully at Desire. That. Well, no one has ever reacted like that to Desire. Like they aren't the most desirable being in the room. No one's ever dared. Just who does this girl think she is? At least the shock is enough to keep Desire enough off their footing to prevent any sort of confrontation between them and Dream, who's incredibly proud of her for that, even if he won't admit it. There will come a day in the future when they'll look back on this dinner, this first meeting, and wonder if it was then that it all began. The endless courting of Desire of the endless, by none other than Unity Kincaid Gadling of the Dreaming. In the late 90s, Death drops in on Hob and Dream unexpectedly. Hob's working on his current project, a soon-to-be new pub, the New Inn. Technically, the place already existed long before Hob bought it, only it worked as a boarding house rather than an inn, the owners renting rooms to young immigrants and young people who might not be able to afford a proper flat, London prices being what they are. After learning that the White Horse's been closed and sold for flats, Hob decides they need something that will carry on its legacy. When seeing that the New Inn is being sold too, and not wanting such a beautiful building being sold only to be demolished, and something plain and generic being built in its place, he buys it himself. It's a lot of work. He basically guts it inside and rebuilds from scratch, but it's good work. The ground floor is set up as a pub. Well above it, Hob arranges a handful of rooms to rent, so it will truly be an inn, while keeping the attic for himself and turning it into a flat for his personal use.
Sister.
Dream, who's been weaving a number of wards and protections for the place to make sure Hob and his patrons will be as safe as he can make them, turns to look at her in obvious surprise. It's not like they never meet. Death does like to drop in when she has time for dinner, a cup of tea, or even just chatting a few minutes. It's not even the lack of warning. Unless it's a planned dinner, like for a celebration or something, Death hardly ever has the chance to let them know in advance that she's dropping by. Rather, it's her expression. She looks, well, a bit lost, actually.
I think I just met my suitor, she mumbles as she drops on the closest bar stool.
You think? Dream's eyes narrow because his sister isn't usually so imprecise in her language.
No, I know he's my suitor, Death nods half absently, only I don't think he knows it.
Hob cannot help himself. He laughs loudly for quite a while, at least until he notices both siblings looking at him. Dream offended, Death the tiniest bit hurt.
I'm sorry.
Hob forces himself to calm down.
It's, you must know I wasn't mocking you, or I didn't mean to laugh at you, just the situation. I mean, I do still laugh at the fact that Dream and I went our whole courtship and didn't realize what we were doing until we were already pretty much getting married, so
it has happened before, is what he's trying to say.
Death need not worry about it.
If Dream and Hob could have such a beginning, and now they're so incredibly happy, there's no doubt that Death and her suitor will get their own happiness as well.
How can we help? He finally asks.
Which is how Hob comes to befriend a young wizard by the name of Harry Potter. Unity and Desire's courtship comes to a head in the early 2020s. Hob and Dream only find out when the pair visit the new inn a month after consummating their union. Dream's affronted. He cannot help it. His consort, on the other hand, isn't surprised at all.
I know you don't like me, brother, Desire hisses defensively, that you never approved.
This isn't about liking you or about any approval, Dream cuts him off, which probably doesn't help matters any.
Hob and I were well aware of your courting, and whatever my personal feelings on the matter, I'd have hoped you, Unity at least, knew that I'd always, always support you.
Desire only seems to be growing more and more tense the more Dream speaks, while Unity looks a bit at a loss, as if not quite sure how to explain things, until Hob speaks up.
Was it a test or a gift?
Hob's question breaks the standoff entirely. Dream's at a loss, not quite understanding what his beloved means.
Desire blinks in shocked disbelief, wondering how exactly a human has managed to see through them.
Unity. She just smiles.
My love, you know I'm totally on your side, and you have perfectly good reasons to doubt Desire, Hob points out before explaining.
However, this is not about you and Desire. This is about Unity and Desire. And like you said, we agreed we'd support her choices. And her choice is Desire. Considering how fraught your relationship has been for,
well, longer than either of us humans have been alive, it does not really surprise me that part of their actual courtship would be this.
And what is this?
Dream still doesn't know. He hates not knowing things.
Choosing Desire.
It's Unity who explains it in the end, softly but with a core of steel in her voice. Putting them first, above any and all others, including
us, me,
Dream corrected, almost as an afterthought, as he was all too aware that the issue was him.
You know I love you. Unity went on, bright-eyed and eager. You're my family, you and Dad. While I'll never forget my human parents, I've known you loved you more and for longer than I ever did them. But Desire is the other half of me.
Just like Hob is the other half of me, Dream finishes for her.
He embraces his adopted daughter tightly, nuzzling into her cheek and neck for a bit, before eventually looking up from her shoulder and straight at his sibling. The two exchange a look, and it's like for the first time in eons they truly understand each other. It might not be perfect, but it's certainly a step forward, and that's entirely priceless. The process of endless courting might not be easy, and it might not be perfect, but those who found their consort will forever believe that the effort and the wait were in the end so very, very worth it. The end.